Tonight on Right on Radio, Liz talks with Lee Gutkind, the author of over 30 books, including You Can't Make This Stuff Up, The Complete Guide to Writing Creative Nonfiction, and the award-winning Many Sleepless Nights, The World of Organ Transplants. In 1991, he founded the magazine Creative Nonfiction. He was instrumental in creating the first MFA program at the University of Pittsburgh. He's known as the godfather of creative nonfiction and currently is a professor and writer in residence at the School for the Future of Innovation in Society at Arizona State University.
In the last part of the hour, Josh talks with Scott Gannis, author of Very Fine People. It's fall 2016 in flyover country, and Jude Glick's mother has just died after a long battle with cancer, leaving behind a house in foreclosure, tens of thousands in medical debt, and compounding psychological trauma. Alternating between raw emotionalism, cutting satire, and wild flights of imagination, Gannis's brilliant debut novel builds to an unforeseen and shattering climax. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Hello, Lee, are you there?
Liz, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now. I am really sorry about the technical difficulties. What we'll have to do...
Me too. I don't know. I've done two other Zooms today. It all worked out pretty well, so God knows what happened. But, you know, technology is kind of challenging.
I know.
It's not secure.
It is what it is. Well, let's start the interview. And you know what I'm going to want to do is do another one at some point fairly soon so that we can do a whole interview about the book.
Okay.
Let's just start real quickly with your position as the godfather of creative nonfiction and talk to us a little bit about what creative nonfiction is.
Well, the easy way to describe creative nonfiction is just to say that creative nonfiction is true stories well told. And to get a little bit more in depth, it's a kind of a double. It's a synchronization between communicating fact and using the literary techniques available to fiction writers, to all writers, in order to make those facts, that information, more compelling and more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book, My Last 8,000 Days, is certainly compelling. I very much enjoyed it. It was I'm 63, so I got a little bit of the aging piece. You know, I'm starting to think about that myself. So what got you thinking about this in particular? Why now and why this?
Well, a couple of answers to that. For one thing, I have spent my entire life, I've written a lot of books, immersing myself for months and years with other people in all kinds of different venues, like robotics, organ transplantation, the motorcycle subculture. I traveled for a year with a crew of National League Baseball umpires. I did all of that, and that's really interesting to become a fly on the wall and become part of someone else's life in someone else's world. But I had never looked deeply into myself in the ways in which I looked into the characters of those other people I was writing about. So that's one thing. I wanted to do something new and different. And the other thing that I think really brought me to the point where I decided that I was finally going to write a memoir was I had a really lousy 670th year. I mean, I have always fought. I have always fought the idea of me aging. And in fact, after my 40th birthday, I asked all of my friends and relatives to not acknowledge my birthday anymore. I just wanted each birthday to pass like any other birthday. And when I hit 70, however, lots of things kind of happened that made me become much more introspective about who I was. My two best friends died mm-hmm. in that same year, one leading up to my 70th birthday and one right after my 70th birthday. My mom, my deepest, closest boon companion, who lived to 94, died 5 days before my birthday. Mm-hmm. And I had a long relationship which fell apart during that year. And I had a book that I thought was going to maybe not change the world, but certainly elongate and elevate my literary status, fell completely and totally apart all through that 70th year. And I was pretty shaken. I was scared. I was nervous about being 70 and not having a support system and not really knowing where to go next. And I think all of us, in many respects, whether you're 60 or 70 or 80, start to get nervous, not just about the end of life. I didn't feel that I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid of not being productive, not having an identity, not being able to make an impact, and more than anything else, not being able to work in a way in which I would feel accomplished and satisfied. And so all those things happened around that time, and I just felt, okay, Lee, it's time to make a change, and the first change you're going to make is to do what you do best, do an immersion, but not do an immersion in other people's lives, but take a deep, solid look into yourself,
mm-hmm.
which is what I did.
I'm curious, I know because I've read the book, but I think our listeners might be interested in knowing what the significance of 8,000 days is as opposed to some other amount of days.
Liz?
Yes.
I don't know you personally, and I like you, but I'm not telling. I wanted that title to be as intriguing as possible, and so the answer to that question emerges as you read the book.
I don't want to give away the beginning or the end.
No, would you? No way. I want my readers to feel compelled and curious and interested, and move ahead from the absolute first sentence to the last 272 pages later.
Although you have written some fiction, I'm correct about that. You've written some fiction, right?
Yes, I have one novel.
One novel. I'm wondering what your choice was about creative nonfiction, how you decided that was going to be the path that you followed more than any other.
Well, first of all, when I started writing, creative nonfiction as a genre, as a label, didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a process for me to kind of come to the idea that you could take your real life or other people's real life and dramatize it and cinematize it so that it could be fascinating and to other people, especially communicating information that other people wouldn't necessarily be interested in, but that you could do by embedding the information in stories. So that was one thing. But the other thing is, I desperately wanted to experience the world, to experience life, like those early writers that I so admired, like Ernest Hemingway and Jack Kerouac. They plunged themselves into the world. And if there was anything more that I wanted to do, I did not want to closet myself for my entire life writing poetry and fiction only. I wanted to live life, and then I wanted to capture that life, all kinds of new and different ways that people lived and orientations that they have. And so it was a combination. I'd love to write. And I wrote regularly and still do every single day for 4 or 5 hours, but I wanted to experience the world and learn about all kinds of different other people in different milieus, and I thought that was the thing to do, to capture nonfiction like a reporter and then turn it into compelling, suspenseful, descriptive prose by using the techniques that other writers had available to them.
Let's talk a little bit about in the book, you talk some about boredom and about loneliness, and I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit for our listeners.
Loneliness for writers. I mean, we spend, I know you know this, Liz, we spend tons of time all by ourselves in a room staring into a display or writing in a notebook, tapping on a keyboard, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. We don't answer the phone. We ignore email, or at least we should. And we just kind of dive into our work as if it's some sort of religion. and it's very difficult. And so in my case, I had a very small but support system, and when those folks died, they died on me, Liz. I found myself all alone. I'm not completely alone. I knew people, but suddenly my work, as much as I loved it and as much as I was obsessed by it, wasn't enough to satisfy me. And I began, and I think I said before that I had a book that fell apart, and suddenly my world was pretty empty. My friends, my book, they were all gone, and there I was pounding away on my keyboard every day, and I felt really closed in and isolated. And I think lots of writers feel that way. We all have our writing spaces, whether it's the basement or the attic or the kitchen. And we live our lives there, and we live our lives in the stories that we're trying to tell of others. And it can be a really empty feeling. And after those events of my 70th year, I felt that way. I felt lost. And for the first time, I felt that my work was not enough for me. That even if I could stay healthy and continue my work, I needed to have connections with others if I was going to be able to continue to be productive. And so I spent a long year and a half, maybe all alone, not necessarily all alone, but pretty much relying on myself, pounding away at my typewriter, look at my keyboard, looking for other articles and essays and books to write. And trying to figure out what I was going to do next and how I was going to do it and how I was going to change not my work life, but my real life. And so it was at first a depressing process that led me to certain revelations that allowed me to make a transformation from only the writer's life to a writer's life plus a real life.
Well, and I'm afraid, as wonderful as this interview is going, that I have to stop now because we have another interview in the second half. And I'm wondering if you would be willing at some point to come back again, and we'll have an interview that doesn't have these myriad technical difficulties. Would you be willing to do that?
I would love it. We haven't really had a chance to talk. I would love to talk with you. I'd love to read for you.
Oh, so, that would be wonderful. Yes, well, let's plan on doing that. I'll get a hold of Kim. I'll have my people call your people. and we'll take care of that. So I'm going to let you go for now, and I'll be getting a hold of your publicist, and we'll set up another time. And I'm very sorry about the technical difficulties.
Well, I'm sorry too, in whichever direction it was, and I was so delighted to be selected as a guest on Write On with you, and I hope we can arrange another time.
I'm sure we can. Okay, I'll let you go then. Thank you so much, Lee, and have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, Scott. Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Wow. We were having some conversations.
Look at us.
Yeah, we're making progress. Okay. Well, Scott, if you are ready, you can begin with your first reading.
As I careened through a stop sign onto Highway 55, a North Minneapolis main drag, bisecting a neighborhood famous for some of the most egregious redlining and predatory lending in U.S. history, a car shaped like a hot dog, a Wienermobile, skidded to a halt. It did not leave a trail of mustard. I swerved, tried to pass it, but then stomped my brakes and saw why we were parked in the middle of the road, a few blocks west of downtown. Pumping signs and chanting, hundreds of marchers clogged the street. Dozens more stood with locked arms in front of me in the Wienermobile. I looked over at the driver. He shook his head, dug into a pocket beneath the red cursive of his uniform, and sucked from a flask. He tipped it toward me, a peace offering. I cranked down my window, caught his toss, swigged, and lofted it back to him. Proletarian solidarity, a random act of alcoholism. Two guys stuck behind a Saturday march for social justice, one trying to get to work and one trying to get on with the worst day of his life. Maybe America wasn't doomed. America is doomed, an organizer blared from a bullhorn. I recognized the voice before I felt the eyes. It was Principal Schmidt shouting down isms and the cops who had showed up to protect the isms.
Very good. That was Scott Gannis? Is that how you say it?
Gannis,
yeah. Gannis, okay. Reading from his debut novel, Very Fine People, Scott Gannis is a former forklift operator from Minneapolis, Minnesota. His work has appeared in various defunct Midwest literary journals and unviewed YouTube channels. He cycles between the floors of Brooklyn and couches of Minnesota. Welcome back to Right on Radio, Scott.
It's nice to be back. different circumstances than the last time I was on Right on Radio, but it's great to be here.
I want to ask you about the title now. The title of this book was brilliant, and more so after I was reading the book. It, like I told you in the email, it took me a moment for me to realize that there was a reference to Trump. Could you talk about, well, it's also an ironic joke as well, that the batch of people we find in this novel are awful. So I was wondering if you could talk about the title. What the other titles you had in mind while you were working on this?
Yeah, so this novel originally started as the story of a museum security guard who was late for work. And it really had nothing to do with politics, at least the way I was thinking about politics at the time. And at that point, the name of the book, or the story, it started as a story, was Paintings Fade Like Flowers, which is a Vincent van Gogh quote. And it really had nothing to do with politics. But then the 2016 election happened, and then Charlottesville and the Unite the Right rally happened. And I started to make a connection between the story of a museum security guard in financial precarity and some of these larger trends we're seeing in U.S. politics. And it seemed like a really useful vehicle into that story. And Very Fine People was still not the title of the book. It was American Carnage. And then it was The Deplorables or something like that. But Very Fine People eventually came to the fore as sort of a way to tie all of this incoherence together.
Mm-hmm. You and I both share a similar work experience in a blue-collar atmosphere that frowns, I think, on people who have left-leaning views or show a modicum of having a background in education that you, it's kind of hard to get away with not carrying on your tongue. Did your experiences reshape your politics in any way? Did it add content to the book?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, politics is not something they think about so much as experience day to day. For instance, if you're a person of color, if you're a working person who doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have access to healthcare, doesn't have stable housing, politics is just happening to you. So for much of my life, I felt like I was someone to whom politics happened. I wasn't a political actor. I didn't really have a sort of a political vocabulary growing up. But as I was able to go to college and was able to sort of transcend, in a sense, my background as a forklift operator and as a person who's going to a liberal arts college when my parents did not go to liberal arts colleges, I started to sort of make these connections and almost code switch in a way between the two worlds.
Yeah. For your publishing debut, I was wondering if you could talk about your experience working with at Ladle Press. They're a really interesting outfit. I think it's worth talking about them for a little bit.
Yeah, so they're awesome. They are out of Dayton, Ohio, which is fitting, I think. Dayton, Ohio, sort of like the very middle of the Middle West, and this book is very Midwestern. They do a lot of like horror fiction, a lot of transgressive fiction, a lot of sort of leftist and alternative fiction. And the day that I learned they were willing to take me on, I'm now based out of New York, and it was literally the day that New York shut down. Like, this was the day that they imposed the lockdowns and everything. Just a really insane day for like a personal triumph amidst just widespread horror, which I guess is sort of like a metaphor for the last 4 or 5 years. But they've been amazing, especially given the circumstances, taking on a former forklift operator from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I have nothing but good things to say about them, though it has definitely been a disorienting experience. No readings. I'm extremely glad I can be here, but this is definitely not how I thought my first book release and tour would be going.
So let's dive into your book a little bit. There's a blending of truth and fiction, I gathered. I was doing a little background research about you, trying to find different things online. I wonder, so how much of both make up very fine people? How close to the character of Jude Glick is Scott Gannis?
The broad outline is very similar in that I lost my mother to cancer. I lost my home to foreclosure. I identify as a failed stand-up comedian. So sort of those raw materials are very much part of me and part of the story. But I regret to say, a former museum security guard. But in sort of like teasing apart these bigger themes, that is something that I didn't really do when I was experiencing foreclosure or when I was experiencing being a precarious museum security guard, right? So in that way, I think Jude is a lot more politically advanced than I was when I was Jude's age.
You mentioned in your email the character Jude Glick really, he didn't kind of connect with you until you invented the character of Steven Scheisskopf, which, once again, overlooked it for a few times. I'm like, if you're a German speaker out there, you'll definitely read and see how funny that is. Where did the idea of Scheisskopf originate?
Yeah, so as I sort of transformed this book from the story of a guy who was late to work into something more overtly political, as I was in my grad program and workshopping this novel, a lot of my peers said that, like, there needs to be an actual antagonist. Like, life itself is not enough of an antagonist. The rise of the president, as antagonistic as he is to so many of us and so many people like Jude, that is not enough of an antagonist. And so I really thought about sort of what would my worst case scenario be if, you know, I had gone to school with someone who is currently in the administration of the federal government, and I settled on Stephen Miller, who is sort of like the chief propagandist for our current president. And I just got to thinking, like, what do the people who knew that guy think about not only him, but their own lives in connection to him, right? That's got to be just like a hallucinatory experience. And so as I developed and thought through what is the thing I most do not want to be, it would be someone like Steven Scheisskopf. That really started to give me the material for, like, okay, now that I have sort of a carbon copy, how can we make Jude more compelling? And how can we create, you know, actual obstacles outside of just life circumstances for him to overcome?
And then on the other side of it, you had Nima Maya, this character who Jude works with in the book. He plays his role, he's pivotal and kind of given direction in his life. There's a great quote from the very beginning that I'm going to tell our audience, that I actually told my friend of mine who thought that's really actually very profound. It's not that you want to be somebody else, you want to be yourself on your own terms. And that, for me, you have a quote at the very beginning of the book that's outside, that opens up the book, that's also very similar to that. It came for me to embody the goal of Jude's existence for the remainder of the story. Was that how you saw him or wanted to see his path go?
Yeah, I definitely came to that realization over time. It was not something I immediately sought to write a novel about or sought to sort of wrestle with or interrogate. But I eventually came to see the story of this novel not so much about contemporary politics or contemporary political figures, but sort of about the emptiness of contemporary American life and the way that so many of us are performing our lives for an audience, whether that's on Instagram or Facebook or right on radio, right? And sort of the way that politics has been really distorted by the way people always have to be on. And I think that quote speaks to a longing that I think a lot of people feel, which is like, you don't always have to be on. You don't have to be a different person. There is a path forward we can find, right, where we can just let ourselves be. It's a little Buddhist, I guess, but I feel like that is not something I see a lot of, especially if you're on Twitter 24/7. There's not a lot of people who are just being out there, and I think we're worse for that.
Yeah, I think you're actually kind of hitting on something that's really important. I thought this about this a lot. People who are maybe Instagram influencers who are very active on social media, so much of it is about trying to put yourself out there, and the appeal for people is trying to be genuine or authentic about what this person is trying to be when the complete act is it's fabrication. I mean, the whole attempt of trying to have these outlets that we use to try to be closer to people are actually have the complete opposite effect. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, the name Jude Glick actually comes from a novel that no one's ever read or heard of by a guy named Bud Schulberg. It was called What Makes Sammy Run? And it was about a guy from sort of like the Jewish ghetto in the Lower East Side of New York City in the 20s, doing whatever he could to become famous and doing whatever he could to become an influential person. And he was willing to burn any possible bridge. And that guy's name was Sammy Glick. And I read that book for a class, and it always sort of stuck with me that the story of our current president in many ways is just someone with an insatiable urge to be the center of attention, and we all have to live with those consequences. And I think that is a story that is playing out across America in, you know, microcosms, certainly with social media and just sort of the way we don't actually connect with each other anymore.
Yeah, totally. So when I was reading through the book, we talked about this briefly over the email about how I kept thinking about David Foster Wallace and this quote that he had talking about trying people who try to come off as hip or cool by being very cynical and having a kind of an outward pessimism towards everything, when really it's just it's a veneer we try to put up to try to not to be human, to not to feel anything. It's a defense mechanism. And it was funny, I was thinking about this, and then I came up to page 80, and you make a direct reference saying, I try to come and try to mitigate my depression by references to David Foster Wallace. And I thought that was really funny that you had mentioned this, and this in the midst of my thinking about this book.
Yeah, David Foster Wallace was really on my mind as I was writing this. David Foster Wallace is, you know, now it's embarrassing and trite to admit, but very influential writer to me. That makes me a cliche white guy, and so it goes, I guess. But Wallace was obsessed with this idea of authenticity and performance, right? Infinite Jest was about that. Many of his short stories were about that. And he was also obsessed with irony and the way that irony can sort of poison people and make them almost less human. And Jude, as a comedian, is very conscious of the fact that he uses humor as a way to make himself less of himself, because to actually like sit down and feel what he's feeling is almost more horrifying than the dissociation he can get through irony.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that side to Jude that I thought was really something I can admit to and relate to myself, this idea of railing against the idea of wokeness or red pilling as being hypocritical as a means of trying to be woke and trying to be more real and more authentic than other people around me. Was this something you were conscious about while writing the character of Jude?
It's difficult because personally, I am very much in favor of wokeness. And I feel like a lot of the rhetoric around the way we talk about anger, like political anger, is sort of incorrect, right? Like, white men are allowed to have a sort of antisocial anger, like our current president has, whereas something that Jude is shooting for is a more pro-social or a more righteous anger. And so what sets him off and what frustrates him is when he gets lumped in with Scheisskopf's anger, right? Which is that antisocial anger. But at the same time, he's aware of the fact that, like, it's not really for him to say that he's a good guy. And so these contradictions he feels as someone who is really well-meaning and is really pro-social, but he doesn't quite have the vocabulary to feel safe or secure in that. That is oftentimes why he'll say something about intersectionality or something out of critical race theory, and it will be spot on, but then he will undercut himself for even knowing that or saying that, or he will not feel that he should be someone speaking about that sort of theory, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, works so well for his character, I mean, is that where all those other characters around him who have this antisocial anger you're referring to, his anger is rather justified. Like, you'd feel like kind of a jerk to try to tell him you should stop being depressed, you should stop being sad all the time, knowing his background. It's hard for you not to want to say, like, I get it, okay? And that's the point, I think, as a reader. You're seeing this, you can't feel, you see his frustration, you can help but empathize with him but understand, but also can't agree with his actions.
Yeah, I think that's where this really became a political novel or a political satire or however you want to, you know, stick it into a genre category, is that, you know, there is this quote, the personal is political. And in many ways, Jude has every reason in the world to be upset. And what upsets Jude even more, what becomes sort of a meta anger, is the fact that he feels someone like Stephen Scheisskopf does not have a right to be angry, you know? And Jude is siding with the underdogs who, to him and to me as just a left-leaning person, have that justifiable anger. But at the same time, anger is just a very dangerous emotional weapon. And it can definitely, well, it takes Jude into some unseemly places over the course of the book.
That meta self-loathing and cynicism that makes up the dialogue from Jude and Very Fine People, it's balanced by this wit and humor, and I think even this charm, this charisma that I think that just kind of exudes him at points. It's hard to push away and deny. Can you describe your process or the difficulty you had in trying to find a balanced tone while writing?
This was the single hardest part of writing the book. Even harder than, in some ways, you know, finding a publisher and writing all of these different drafts. It was pinning down the tone of the novel. And when I started writing this, a lot of the personal material, the things that were the backdrop to getting me to start writing this, they were very new and very raw, and they were still happening. And I needed a little distance to modulate those feelings and to find a way to express the anger, but also to express joy occasionally and express love and express some of those pro-social things. And the single comment that I got more often than not when I was workshopping these pieces in graduate school was that, like, the tone is disjointed and you need to find a way to blend it all together. And I'm not sure if I ever quite did. I think I got a lot closer than initial drafts, and I'm glad that it resonated as something that was sort of complex rather than just one note. But it was very, very hard to find a way to give credence to this anger and these feelings of depression, but not overwhelm the reader.
I want to talk to you about that briefly, too. There's that cynical nature of depression you demonstrate very well with Jude that turns, it's very inward, it's very self-directed, and it's very self-absorbed. And I think in times that usually when you do that, your whole mental space is occupied thinking about your own problems, your own needs, and it usually pushes everyone away from around you. And there's a character, Addie, who in the book attacks Jude directly for those reasons, and it's ruthlessly honest. And I thought that was such a powerful thing for you to do. And I was wondering if you could talk about that and that, how you got into that space to try to find this and put it on paper the way you did.
Yeah, I feel like this ties a bit into the different types of anger and the different types of feelings that are centered in the way we talk about politics when it comes to white men. Like, white men are allowed to feel anger. They're allowed to feel rage. They're allowed to basically behave however they want. And it was very important for me to push back on that in the book, because Jude, again, is warranted to feel pretty bad, but that doesn't give you, you know, the go-ahead to be a bad person, right? The whole point of the things he decides to do is that he wants to make the world a better place, or at least that's the story he tells himself. And so when his anger and depression and self-loathing become a sort of thing that does affect other people and isn't advancing the goals that he thinks he wants to advance, then I thought it was really important for someone to call him out on that.
Right. We have a little bit more time left here, Scott. I want to give some time to ask you, what are you working on anything right now? Are you just trying to out there, trying to promote this? What are you currently doing?
Yeah, so I am working through two different projects. I'm not sure which one will be my second novel. One of them is sort of it's kind of an apocalyptic story set in New York with a group of right-wing Christian fascists who kind of take over New York City and how that affects just other people trying to live day to day. And then the other project I'm currently working on is a book about sort of the failures of higher education and the tuition-driven model. My day job is in higher ed, so I have a lot of negative opinions about the way things are going in higher education that, shockingly, I guess I'm just not very creative, right? It's either always about fascism or it's always about, like, failing systems. But one of those will probably be my next novel.
Is there a spot where people can find you online?
Yeah, so you can find me at Scooter Gannis on Twitter. Here I am. I'm railing against social media, and yet I'm on Twitter pretty much every waking hour. So I'm out there. It's not good, but I'm out there. And I would encourage you to, I have pieces that are sort of floating around the internet, as I said, unviewed YouTube channels, but it's sort of mostly aggregated via Twitter.
Well, I was trying to find, so what's your YouTube name called?
Well, I'm sort of part of a loose collective of comedians and, like, weird artsy people. Our overall thing is called off-brand content. So give that a look. Some of it's good, some of it's not good. All of it is very weird, very off-brand. So at least, like, you know, this isn't false advertising.
You say what you are right there in the title.
Right.
You listened to my conversation with Scott Gannis talking about his book, Very Fine People. I recommend it. Scott, thanks so much for being here on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now this.